Počúvate epizódu podcastu V ženskom rode. Som jeho autorka Katarína Stričková a každý týždeň vám v ňom prinášam zaujímavé myšlienky a životnú skúsenosť inšpiratívnych žien medzi nami. Ďakujem vám za priazeň a za to, že v našej spoločnosti pomáhate šíriť ľudskosť, slušnosť a nádej. Christina Lamb is one of Britain's leading foreign correspondents and a best-selling author. She has reported from most of the world's hotspots, starting with Afghanistan after an unexpected wedding invitation led her to Karachi in 1987, when she was just 22. She moved to Peshawar to cover the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet Union, and within 2 years she had been named Young Journalist of the Year. Since then she has won 15 major awards, including 5 times being named Foreign Correspondent of the Year, and Europe's top war reporting prize, the Prix Bayeux. She was made an OBE by the Queen and is an honorary fellow of University College Oxford. Together we talk about her book, Our Bodies, Their Battlefield, and on stories that move us. You started to be or to cover foreign relations. I know that you started as a 22 years old. How and why? I know there was a wedding, some sort of.
Yes, it all started because of a wedding. Basically, I always wanted to write and not really to be a journalist, but to write books. But then when I was at university, I got invited to a party, which turned out to be for the university newspaper. And the people spoke about the things they were doing, and it seemed very interesting. So I joined and ended up actually editing that paper. So when I left university, I spent my summer as an intern at the Financial Times. And one day the foreign editor was supposed to go to a lunch of South Asian politicians. And last minute, he couldn't go. So he said to me, "Oh, you're always going on about India," which I was very interested in. "Why don't you go to this lunch?" So I did, and I sat next to somebody who was the Secretary General of the Pakistan People's Party, which was the party of Benazir Bhutto. And at that time, Pakistan was a military dictatorship, and Benazir was in exile in London. So this man asked me if I would like to interview Benazir. Of course, I said yes. So I went to interview her. And the day I went to interview her was actually the day that she announced her engagement to Asif Ali Zardari. So her flat was full of bouquets of flowers. Anyway, I wrote up the interview. Then I actually got a job in TV, regional TV in UK. And a few months after that, I came home from work and there was this most beautiful gold inscribed invitation on my doormat. And it was to her wedding in Pakistan. So I went to this wedding. I'd never been to Pakistan. This was in December 1987. And it was the most incredible introduction, as you can imagine, to Pakistan. Pakistani weddings are very colourful and long anyway. But being Benazir, hers was like something out of the Arabian Nights. And but it was also after each of this ceremonial events every day, there would then be gatherings at her house with her political colleagues to discuss how they were going to try and topple the dictatorship. And so I was meeting all these people who had been arrested or tortured or tear gassed to try and bring democracy to their country, which was something I'd always taken for granted. So I was fascinated and I couldn't really imagine going back to England and working in local news. So I went back and gave him my notice and went to live in Pakistan. But at that time, it was the war in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union were there. And when I spoke to foreign editors in England about freelancing from Pakistan, they weren't really interested, but they told me we are interested in Afghanistan. So because of that, I actually went to live in a town called Peshawar on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. and started traveling in and out of Afghanistan with the Mujahideen who were fighting the Russians, and found it absolutely fascinating. So that's how I started.
And what made you stay in there for 2 years, I think it was, in Peshawar? And you were only 22 years old. You were not scared, afraid. I can't really imagine. Let me think what I was doing in 22.
No, I wasn't scared. I was just fascinated. The people I was traveling with were just really interesting people. And, you know, their country had been invaded by the Soviet Union, as it was then. So they were fighting to try and get it back. So I was very fascinated by what they were doing. And actually, it made me feel, because Afghans are great storytellers. Lots of the people that I was traveling with were illiterate, but they could tell amazing stories. And it made me feel as though that I couldn't make up such stories like that. So it was, rather than write novels, which is what I had imagined doing, that actually it was better to tell other people's stories and become a journalist. I'd gone there as a journalist, but to stay working as a journalist rather than doing it for a short time, which is what initially I had thought. And so I've done it ever since. And I've also gone back and forth to Afghanistan ever since, because it became a passion, really. And also, unfortunately, Afghanistan has, you know, never really come out of war or difficulty. And so there's always been reasons to go back and forth.
Did you speak any of foreign languages at the time when you arrived?
Not useful for Pakistan or Afghanistan, no.
So who interpreted for you?
Well, when I was traveling with the Mujahideen, I learned quite a lot of Pashto, because actually I was just starting out, so I didn't have money for an interpreter. And also it was dangerous where I was going and things, so you wouldn't necessarily want to take someone else with you. I didn't know anything then about fixes or anything like that. So I usually there was somebody in the group that spoke some English, and then, you know, I managed to learn some. And so it was fine.
How did you manage to persuade them to accept you, to talk to you, to take you with them?
Well, I mean, they were, by that time, so the Russians invaded in 79. I got there in 87. So by that time, they were used to having journalists, and they knew, you know, let's not forget, this was the sort of last fight of the Cold War, if you like. The Mujahideen were dependent on Western backers for weapons, for funding. And so there was a lot of interaction, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the CIA was basically funding a lot of it. So they had a lot of interaction with the West, and they knew that, I suppose a little like Ukraine today, that the media was important, because people knew what the Russians were doing to them.
But still, it was end of the 80s. So your gender, the fact you were a woman, didn't, and young woman,
I didn't really think about that at the mm-hmm. time. I mean, it's interesting because obviously Afghanistan's a very patriarchal society. So there were some groups. So there were seven different main groups that were fighting in Afghanistan, and journalists tended to kind of get to know one or two in particular that you travel with. There were some more what we used to call fundamentalist groups, more hardline Islamist groups who would not have taken women. There was one commander who sadly was killed just after 9/11, Abdul Haq, who I became very friendly with, who was commander for Kabul. And he used to laugh, saying, you know, girls don't go to war, why should we take you? And he actually, because I wanted to go with his men because they were fighting around Kabul, he made me actually like go on one of their training courses. And I mean, by chance, I happened to be quite a good shot, really, because I had been a lot to like circuses and things when I was a kid where there were shooting ranges. And so they were quite impressed that I, you know, at the shooting exercises, that I could often shoot better than them.
Well done. So they respected you.
Yeah, obviously I wasn't getting this fight and would never and have never carried a weapon. But, you know, it just meant that there was a bit more respect. And some of them, I remember one group where I was going, who actually became the Taliban, interestingly, but then were known as the Mullahs Front, that, you know, their commander said to them, you know, if you don't look after this woman, I'm going to chop you up into small pieces and kill all your family. And, you know, it was quite an incentive to make sure I came back with intact and with no complaints. So I didn't have any problems. But I was less aware of it at the time, I think, because I didn't really know and I just started out. Now, when I look back, it's more surprising to me that I was able to do what I did, but it wasn't really. And sometimes, you know, I had to go dressed as a man, you know, wearing a turban and everything.
How do you get people to tell you their stories, which are often deeply personal? How do you, is it something that a good journalist must possess?
So I think that women are better journalists than men, being completely biased, because I think we're better at listening. And I always say to young journalists, you know, don't be afraid of silence. You know, if somebody is speaking or don't seem very keen to say very much, don't feel that you've got to fill in the space. You know, sometimes if you don't say anything, if you say nothing, people then sort of feel they do need to speak, right? Nobody just sits there silent. So often they'll then start saying more things to you. I think possibly when I was starting out also, people thought, you know, that you were a young woman, that you were kind of harmless, and so maybe told you things they might not have told a middle-aged man. Yeah, I think, you know, don't try and force your opinions on other people. Let people speak. And, you know, I'm just naturally very curious and very interested in other people's stories. And so I just never really had a problem getting people to speak about often quite personal things.
As I read the book, one of the most emotional books in my life, I got a question immediately in my thoughts. How do you deal with your own emotions when you hear the stories?
So these are, particularly in my book, Our Bodies, They're Battlefields, which is about sexual violence. These are really difficult stories to listen to. I know that they're difficult for people to read when I write them. They're difficult to write. And I found the book very hard to write. I didn't write for long periods each day. I just wrote for a bit and then would, you know, go for a walk or but you know, the fact is, however difficult they were for me to listen to or write, they're way more difficult for the women and girls to go through. And so I felt very strongly that, you know, those people had trusted me with their stories, and I had a responsibility to write them in the best way and make, you know, spread them to as many people as possible. Because frankly, if I, as a war correspondent, mostly covering conflict for more than 30 years, had no idea just how widespread rape still is in war and possibly increasing in recent years. Why should anyone else have that idea? I mean, most people are not out in war zones. So I thought that there was a responsibility to tell those stories. And also, you know, I frankly felt very sad about what was happening, but also angry because these women and girls were coming forward and talking about what had happened to them, whether it's the Yazidis or the women and girls taken in Nigeria, like the Chibok girls by Boko Haram, or women from the Rohingya community in Myanmar or Burma being taken by Burmese military and gang raped. You know, all those women spoke out about what had happened to them. So there was no excuse. Nobody could say they didn't know. And yet nobody was being brought to justice for what happened or have yet been brought to justice. And I couldn't understand it. I couldn't answer when they asked me, why is nobody doing anything? And I felt baffled and really angry. So I started researching more and more about, you know, why no one was doing anything, what the law was, what happened in the past. And I didn't set out actually to write a book about it. I just was trying to be able to answer those questions. But then it became clear to me that actually nobody had written a book about it. It was like this whole huge part of history that where women had just been written out of. And so I decided to put all of those stories together and tell another side of some wars that, you know, people think they know, but actually this is what happened to the women.
You started the book with the myths and the Troy War, and I just realized that, as you said, the whole of history of the mankind is full of violence on women, which we just somehow seem to accept that it is just the way it is in conflict.
Yes, I mean, I think that there's a lot of violence against women in society anyway. I mean, supposedly one in three women will experience violence against them in their lifetime. So, you know, if that's happening in our societies, obviously in conflicts where there's no rules and society sort of breaking down, it may happen much more. But I particularly focused in the book, it seemed to me in recent years we've seen rape used much more as a weapon of war. So I was focusing a lot on that, where, you know, what rape wasn't just happening in the breakdown and chaos of war. It was happening because fighters were being told to do it, and for a particular reason, whether it was to change the ethnic balance of a country, impregnate the women, destroy their fertility, or take over an area by terrorizing and humiliating the population. And unfortunately, raping the women and girls is a very effective way of doing it. Fighter said to me, rape is cheap, you know, is the cheapest weapon known to man. It's cheaper than a Kalashnikov bullet. And I'm afraid that's true. I mean, I've just come back from Ukraine and, you know, unfortunately we're seeing it yet again there. So, you know, something that's happening again and again. It's not just something from history or something far away. This is something happening today now in Europe.
This is what was going to be my next question, that with the war in Ukraine now, would you have to add another chapter to the book?
Oddly enough, so a Ukrainian publisher, which I'm very pleased about, asked if they could publish the book and asked me if I would write something specifically in the introduction about what's happening in Ukraine. So I am
I'm doing that. I am adding. And it's very sad, isn't it, to have to add yet another chapter in 2022.
I know that there are already some investigations taking place. There were Slovak experts sent, forensic experts sent to Ukraine. But do you think that there may be any shift in perception of rape and violence against women just because these women are white and European?
Look, I mean, first of all, I'm very sad and horrified to see this happening yet again in a war. And I'm afraid, the Russians have form in this. This is very similar to what happened in 1945 in Germany and Eastern Europe. In the civil war in Russia, the soldiers unfortunately do seem to often engage in rape of women and girls. And actually in Ukraine, I'm also hearing stories of boys and very sadistic kind of, of attacks too, sisters being raped in front of each other and really horrendous things. To me, the one positive about this is the first time that I've seen widespread reporting of it. I mean, I struggled a lot in the past to get stories about war rape in my newspaper. I had editors, male editors, saying to me, nobody wants to read these stories. It's good that we're now seeing, I've never seen so much reporting about war rape as now because of Ukraine, and lots of people saying this is unacceptable, we must do something, from international figures to Zelensky, and Ukraine is acting very fast in trying to amass evidence and already has held war crimes trials. I don't remember that ever happening during a war in real time before. So that's all positive. Is it because they're white, they look like us? I don't know. I mean, I think, of course, the fact that it's in Europe, so it's near, makes a difference. That's one of the reasons this war is just so shocking, that this is happening in Europe in 2022. I think my point is, it's very shocking that these other examples I'm giving you, that rape is happening so much in war anywhere in the world.
Exactly.
And the point of my book partly also was, I think there is a tendency of some people to think, oh, this is something happening, far away, maybe in a remote village in Congo or something. And no, it's not. It's happening. In my book, I went to 12 different countries on 5 continents, from South America to Europe to Asia to Southeast Asia, Africa, to show people this is not happening in one or two remote places. This is happening all over the world now. And frankly, I could have spent the rest of my life writing a book because it's so widespread. So when it started happening in Ukraine, I was sad, but I wasn't really surprised.
Even if it would be only in some remote village in Congo or in Afghanistan or in Syria, it doesn't matter, because the dignity of that woman or those women should be the same. It is the same as ours.
Yeah, no, that's the point. But I'm also saying that people can't try and shut themselves off and think that this is something that happens far away from wherever they are. This is not the case. And there is a problem generally with convictions of rape. I mean, in the UK last year, only 1% of rapes that were reported to the police resulted in charges. That's so difficult to understand how that can possibly be. That's not, there's no other crime where it's anywhere near that kind of number. And so, and in the same way, war rape is the most neglected war crime. So I think there is a real issue here. Dr. Mukwege, the amazing gynecologist who runs Panzi Hospital in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has treated 55,000 women and girls who have been raped, so knows more about it, I think, than probably anyone on earth. He asks the question, you know, if this was happening on this scale to men, and around the world, hundreds of thousands of men were being genitally mutilated, left traumatized, physically damaged, and that was all being done to them by women, do we really think that nobody would be doing anything about it? And I think that's a very valid question.
Do you think that gender plays any role in how stories are covered in the media?
Yes, of course. I think, you know, I don't think you can generalize completely, but I think men and women do often see things differently, find things different to cover. So I, as a war correspondent, am much less interested in the fighting, what I call the bang bang. I'm much more interested in how people live during a war, and how they feed, educate, protect their children and shelter their elderly, and that's usually the women. So I focus much more on that. I think, you know, also having more female editors means that the issues that affect women get covered more, and that war in particular is looked at in a different kind of way.
Going back to your books, I read that you had 9 of them written, but I presume the one which is coming out these days is the 10th?
It is.
Which one was the most difficult to write?
Yes, the last one, Our Bodies, Their Battlefield, just because the subject was so difficult.
You said that the foreign correspondent must have an endless curiosity, a little bit of charm, ability to pee anywhere, and eat everything. Would you anyhow amend it these days?
No, I think those things are all very valid. I mean, I think determination is a key quality too, to be able to. I used to say to often that I don't take no for an answer to me, like no is a starting point, because you're always trying to get in places. People generally don't want journalists in places, right? So we're always trying to get into places people don't want us. So you have to be persistent. But I had once, my son, who was then quite young, had been some of my talks where I said that I don't take no, or that I see no as a starting point. And he told me one day that he'd forgotten his bus pass to get on the bus to school. And the driver was insisting he got off, and he didn't. He just stood there and he said, "I remembered what you said." But no, and I was slightly worried. What have I done?
A good example, Mum.
I'm a great believer, like I said, about the silences, that if you don't speak, people will speak to you. That also, there's something to be said in just staying in places. So like if you go somewhere and they're refusing to let you do something, but you don't go away, you just stand there or sit there, that quite often in the end, they'll just get fed up and let you get into wherever you want to go. Or not always, but a lot of times it has worked.
Did your motherhood, the fact you had a child, anyhow change the way you see world and people and do your job?
Yes, of course. Because, I mean, first of all, I guess it made me more careful with what I did, because I was responsible for somebody else. But also, you know, when you see women who have spent days crossing mountains to escape a war with, you know, having to sort of scrape moss off rocks to feed their children, or in a place where their children, like Afghanistan State, where girls can't go to high school. I mean, if you're a mother yourself, I think it brings home much more. You immediately think, you know, how would I feel if I wasn't able, I had to say to my child, sorry, you can't go to school anymore, or there's nothing to eat, or, you know. So I think it does change the way that you feel. I don't mean that you can't report otherwise that you need to be a parent, but it does sort of bring home, you just can't help putting yourself in their place.
Is there a particular trait in human nature you particularly admire?
I've always thought that integrity is the most important thing. I mean, for me as a journalist, you know, I want people to feel that when I write something, they can trust, you know, what it is I've written, and know that, you know, I've gone to the place, that I've spoken to the people, and, you know, really telling them what's going on there, particularly now in these days of fake news and misinformation. So I really value, you know, it's very important to me to have a reputation that people trust, and also, you know, trust me with their stories, that I won't do anything to damage them or put them in danger. Of course, you know, some people, just by speaking to journalists, are going to be in danger, and it's also very important that we as journalists, you know, explain to people just what it means when they tell their stories to us. I think the whole issue of informed consent is very important, not just asking someone their permission, but making sure they really understand, because now, you know, when someone tells you their story, it doesn't just appear in a newspaper and it gets thrown away the next day. It's there on the internet, you know, for the rest of their lives. So that's important that they understand.
What is on your nightstand?
I read lots of books. I mostly read novels. Actually, I'm just reading a book by a Ukrainian novelist called Andriy Kursky, which is called Death and the Penguin.
And you like it?
I like it. Well, I've literally read one chapter, but so far I'm liking it a lot. But I have a pile of books always by my bed, so that's just
and
what's on
your,
top.
And who's your favorite writer, if you may inspire us?
I'm afraid that changes because I read so much. So sometimes I, you know, go through a phase of, you know, I discover someone and then read that like mad. So, I mean, of journalistic work, I used to be a big fan of Ryszard Kapuscinski, although I'm afraid some things have come out questioning the veracity of some of his reports. But the way he writes is, or he wrote, was amazing. In terms of novels, I really like Murakami, the Japanese novelist. But I read voraciously. I read lots of books and nonfiction as well. I mean, which tends to be more related to what I'm interested in at the moment. So recently I was reading quite a lot of Ukrainian history.
Počúvali ste epizódu podcastu V ženskom rode. Nový diel vychádza každý týždeň v piatok v rámci podcastu Denník N podcasty. Jeho najstaršie diely nájdete v originálnom podcaste V ženskom rode, vo všetkých podcastových aplikáciách a v hudobnej knižnici Spotify. Rozhovory si môžete každý týždeň aj prečítať na webe Denníka N. Do počutia a do čítania o týždeň.